And so, at least for this simplest of circuits, the rule is, if you want to calculate the probability for a circuit, you simply change the blue chalk to white. And that gives you the probability. Or you say you change the backslash math to normal maths font. I'm not sure what the name is for the normal math font. It might just be normal math font. Does anyone know? I don't, anyway. Yeah, anyway, it's the default font. It's the default generally, although if you ever LaTeX talk in Beamer, it messes with that, which is a real nuisance for this, so you have to go back and change the default. So this is nice that at least in this very simple case, we just change blue to white to get the probability. We can even draw this as a, we can draw this as a diagram. So Penrose came up with this diagrammatic notation for tensor calculations. I don't know if any of you have come across that. It's sort of the obvious thing. So this, each of these are the tensors, and then when you connect two tensors with a line, then you're summing over the index here. So in that case, you're just taking the same diagram in white. I've rotated it by 90 degrees, but that doesn't really matter. So the question is, can we do this generally? So what I'm going to do is I'll show you that if you have a circuit consisting of A, then B, then C, one after the other, then it does work for any circuit. And then to get more general circuits than that, one which have some width as well as some length, we need to make an extra assumption. And this is the assumption of tomographic locality. So first of all, consider this circuit. So you can think of this as you have a preparation, you have a transformation, and also the type of system might change. And then you have a final result, which could be one, corresponds to one outcome of a measurement. Each of these boxes can have an outcome, has an outcome set associated with it. We want to calculate the total probability for the joint probability for the whole thing. To answer this, we could ask, what is the what's the state associated with having A then B? And this turns out to be quite simple. we know that the state here is just given by putting a fiducial measurement on top. So the state is given by the probability A. Is given by this, which as a diagram just corresponds to the probability of that. Is that clear? Because that's the way we determine a state, is by looking at the probabilities with respect to this special set of fiducial results. So B goes from 1 up to K sub B. And then what we can do is we can think of this as being essentially like this case, except that now, rather than just having B, we've got this sort of, these two boxes. So we can write that as this, because what we've got is a bunch of measurements that are labeled by this index B, and for each of these, you'll be able to write something like this down, but you'll have an extra label up here. So we can write it down like this. So this is the state that you get after by this preparation. Any questions? No. Okay. And so consequently, the probability of the actual circuit we wanted to find is equal to the state that's prepared by the first two boxes, which is the thing we just calculated, followed by the vector associated with this. So now we're just applying the equation we had previously, where this is the preparation and this is the final result. Okay. So we can see that the blue goes to white rule. Works again. Okay. Okay. So that's clear.
Nope. It's not clear to me why we need it to go through that.
Okay. Well, there's no extra assumption, but I think it doesn't follow straight away. It's not obvious that the state that's produced by the first two boxes is given by this thing. And what's happening here is that you produce a state by the first box, then here you have a linear transformation of that state. So you can think of the middle box, the B box, as corresponding to some linear transformation. on the first box. In quantum theory, an analogous thing happens that if you have a density matrix, then and you send it for a box, then you apply a linear map, a completely positive linear map. I'm not sure what notation you used with Joe. So this is the linear map that's applied. This state is transformed by this linear map, and to give you a new state. Okay. And of course, you can also draw this as a diagram. Like so. So what about a more complicated circuit? So, for example, so this was the circuit we considered at the beginning. We say that this is true, where this is a tensor calculation. In symbolic notation, we'd say so that's writing it down in symbolic notation. So I'll give you the condition that enables you to say that. This is certainly a sufficient condition. It may not be a necessary condition. Tomographic locality. This is often called in the literature local tomography. And I've been pushing the alternative name tomographic locality, since I think it's really a locality principle that we have here. But you'll see the other principle in literature. So definition. Definition of tomographic locality, or TOMLOC, as I affectionately call it, is the following. So the state associated with the preparation of a composite system can be determined by making measurements on the components. So we have some composite preparation, various systems, and we consider measurements like so, and we're allowed to use lots of different measurements, lots of different results to extract probabilistic information. And such probabilistic information can be used to construct the state. So to do tomography, it's usually called tomography, to get the state. Because of linearity, this means that we can write the state down like so. We can say we can just use the fiducial basis that we had introduced earlier. So the point is that to determine the state associated with this, we don't have to bring together pairs of subsystems and make joint measurements on them. We can just do separate measurements on each of those, and that's sufficient to give us the state. So you can see here what we have is a tensor which has Ka times Kb times Kc. Entries. Okay. Any questions? So maybe Jason first.
So what's the significance between doing like measurements on individual states like you've drawn right there versus like doing joint measurements like up there on D? as like two lines going into the box.
Where are we? Here. Yeah. So the point of the state is you should be able to use it to make probabilistic predictions for any kind of circuit that box finds itself in, that preparation finds itself in. What we're assuming here is that even if you have, let's just take a simpler case where we have two lines going into a box. If we have something like this, sorry, I should have used blue, of course. We try to be consistent. The probability of this is equal to that. So this thing might not factorize between these two parts because this is a joint measurement. Whereas over here, if we have something like this, it would factorize. So we'd be able to write it down as, let's write A, C, D. The probability for that would be factorize. And so what's happening is it turns out that in order to determine all the properties of this state, it's sufficient to do these kinds of measurements. And then you can use the thing that you obtain, like so, in a calculation where you have a measurement or a result that can't be regarded as corresponding to separate measurements on the two systems. Does that clarify?
Is the ABC becomes a tensor, to what extent does it have tensor properties, or is it just about like the component
doctor? It does actually have tensor properties, so you can consider transforming your fiducial measurements. So you make a particular choice of fiducial measurements. I think you raised this point yesterday. So you can make a particular choice of fiducial measurements, and that corresponds to choosing a basis. But then you can change to a different set of fiducial measurements, and that corresponds to a different basis, and it corresponds to a tensor transformation on this object. So it is really a tensor. Yeah. In the papers I've written on this, I talk about objects called duotensors, and they have a bit more structure, but I'm not going to do that in this course. Okay. So let's see. So I think what I'm going to do is I'm just going to leave it as an assertion that with this assumption of tomographic locality, you can now take any circuit, you can just turn blue to white to get the probability. It's almost obvious, and yeah. For those of you that are interested, just ask me later, and I'll show you how it pans out. Or just think about it for a few minutes. Okay. So I just want to talk about this local tomography assumption. It's an interesting assumption. So there are many equivalent statements of local tomography. Tomographic locality. So here's one. So it's pretty obvious that this would be true. If you have local, if you have topographic locality, it's pretty obvious that this follows. It's not so obvious that the converse is true also, but it is. And if we take this statement, then we can investigate a few theories that we know well. So I want to show you how this pans out in the case of classical and in the case of the classical and quantum situation. But before I do that, I need to define this quantity. So this is taken to be the maximum number of preparations that can be reliably distinguished in a single run for a given system type. Say perfectly. In the case of quantum theory, for example, if you have a qubit, then n is equal to 2. It's the dimension of the Hilbert space more generally. In the classical case, if you have a ball that can be in one of five boxes, then n is equal to 5. If you have a die that has 6 faces, then n is equal to 6. A coin that has 2 sides, n is equal to 2. And so on. So here, imagine we have a set of preparations which we label by M, it should be N. So we have some set of preparations. So in the case of quantum theory, M equals 1 could be a spin down along the z direction state, and M equals 2 could be a spin up along the z direction state. And then we follow it by a measurement. So this is a bunch of results having non-overlapping outcome sets whose union is equal to the set of all outcomes. So n labels each result. We want the probability of that to be equal to delta mn. So this means we have a set of states that can be perfectly distinguished. And then if we have, you know, if you go through the full, all the different states that are possible, all the different preparations that are possible, and find the largest number that can be distinguished in such a scenario, then that tells us what n is equal to. Okay. So this is an operationally defined quantity, but we know what it is in quantum theory. It's the dimension of the Hilbert space. Okay. So now let's make a companion assumption to topographic locality. I'll call it information locality. This is the assumption. If you have a composite system, then N NAB is equal to NA times NB. Okay. This seems like a very natural assumption. For example, if you have a coin and a die, then the coin has N equals 2, the die has N equals 6, and then the total number of the things that you can distinguish perfectly is 12. But it doesn't have to be true. You could imagine that that one of the systems would unlock extra states, you know, when it was combined with the other system. So it's possible, in principle, that NAB is greater than NA times NB. But it seems like a very reasonable thing to assume. And it's also true in quantum theory. So the dimension of a Hilbert space for a composite system is equal to the product of the dimensions for each of the systems. Okay. Oh. Missed that. So here's a few more assumptions. I think very natural assumptions. So assume that there's some function of n that gives you the k, the number of fiducial results you need to characterize a state. And also assume that this function is monotonically increasing, strictly monotonically increasing. So if you increase the n by 1, then you also increase k. And assume that we can find systems that have any integer value of n that we want. So if we take now these two assumptions, tomographic locality and information locality, then we get that this is true. And we can show that if this is true, and we also have these other assumptions, then it follows from a little bit of number theory that K A equal to n, lost the chalk, n a to the r. Okay. So can you say that? Does what, sorry? K?
Yeah.
Which one?
What kind of R?
So I'm saying that K is equal to N to the power R. Oh, sorry, yeah. So R is a theory dependent thing. So for a given theory, you have a fixed value of R. Write that down. Yeah, so every theory has its own value of R. So so let's just go through some examples. So if you have K equal to N, so R is equal to 1, then this is classical probability theory. Consider, for example, a ball that can be in one of n boxes. Well, to characterize that system, you need to give a probability for each for it being in each of the boxes. And so the number of probabilities you need is just equal to the number of boxes, so k is equal to n. And normally, you characterize a classical system by a probability distribution over over the different states the system can be in. And in particular, you know, if you have a system, for example, with three states, then you have a probability for each of those, and the states are constrained to lie in a simplex, because the probabilities have to add to one, or if you allow subnormalization, they have to add to one or something less, in which case they'd lie inside this. Tetrahedron. Here's the next example. This is where R equals 2. And quantum theory fits in to this. Quantum theory isn't the only theory, incidentally, that fits into here. If you remember the toy model, for the Speckens toy model, then it sort of fits into here too. A guy called Kirkpatrick has come up with other classical models where you have some restriction that end up producing this behavior. But quantum theory is the case that we're interested in. And let me just explain where this comes from in the case of quantum theory. So if you look at the density matrix for a general n-dimensional Hilbert space, then down the diagonal, you have probabilities because they correspond to the probability of seeing the system in the state, so in a state associated with the basis that you're representing this density matrix in. And then above the diagonal, you have various entries. This will be, I guess, 2, 3, and so on. And down below the diagonal, the entries are just the complex conjugates of these ones. So if you do some counting, you can see that K is equal to, well, we have n entries down the diagonal. Plus, above the diagonal, we have n times n minus 1 entries over 2 factorial. Just let me count those. But each of them is complex, so that means they give us 2 real numbers. And the reason they're complex is because we have an underlying complex Hilbert space. And this is equal to n a squared. So it's sort of striking that the two theories that we know best correspond to the first two elements, the first two cases of this hierarchy. I call this the Wouters hierarchy because he was the first person to suggest this. The actual proof that this follows, that this is actually the only way of satisfying these equations, is in the back of a paper, one of my papers. In the archive. And then, so of course, the natural question that arises is it possible to construct more complicated theories corresponding to R equals 3, R equals 4, and so on? And I struggled with this for a number of years, and I didn't achieve anything interesting. Other people have also looked at this question. Karol Chekhovsky has a paper where he has something like this. And there's even more recent work in Bruckner's group in Vienna. But I don't think anything really compelling has been found for higher values of R. And there are now good reasons to think that you're not going to get sensible theories for higher values of R. But let me just show you how this works out in a few other examples. What about if instead of having complex numbers, we do quantum theory on a real Hilbert space? In that case, so let's call this complex quantum theory. So what if you have real quantum theory? Well, then we get the same equation, except we have to change this 2 to 1. And what about if instead we do quaternionic quantum theory?
So the second line is the real one.
This is the real case, yeah. I've got an R there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that just means coefficients of states have to be real?
That just means so the Hilbert space has to be real. So if you write down a pure state in the Hilbert space, the coefficients are real. That's right. So then when you form the density matrices, the off diagonal terms are also going to be real.
Would R no longer be a whole number in that case?
R. So actually, so what happens here is this is simply not equal to n to the power r.
So,
no, we showed under these assumptions it had to be. So the thing that really is failing is local tomography. Yeah, and I'll show you that explicitly. The other assumption, the information locality is still true, but local tomography fails. And the quaternionic case is also interesting, so let's just do the same thing. So you have four real parameters in a quaternion. So these are quadratic functions of n, but they're not equal to n to the power r. So actually what happens is in the, let's use white. For the real Hilbert space, I'm getting confused with all the colors. We have the composite system has more than you would get from just a product. And in the quaternionic case, it has less. For the quaternions.
Yeah.
Is that the standard is Q, isn't it? Is that right?
I'm saying the letter Q is like.
Oh, it's like blackboard font, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, it's my attempt at doing blackboard font on the blackboard. Oh, well, the next Q is, it hasn't got the straight. So if I magnify it, I've done this and that. So it's interesting just to look at how this works for two qubits. When I say qubits, I want to put, because these may be real Hilbert, these may be real Hilbert space or quaternionic Hilbert space. So let's consider two cases. The case where n equals 2, this is a single.
Do people really use quaternionic quantum theory?
I mean, people have studied it. Stephen Adler has a whole book on this subject. Although he does it for the infinite dimensional case, so I don't think he anywhere points out this issue.
And the results of such theories, are they identical to the results of usual quantum theory, or?
No, I think they're not. There's real problems with Cartesianic quantum theory because of this. It's actually very difficult to define subsystems. This property, this actually violates my assumption one. Mm-hmm. This is the assumption that you can give a probability mm-hmm. for a circuit, which is closed circuit, and you can show that this violates that. So you get into very strange physics where you can't really mm-hmm. talk about subsystems by themselves. So I'm going to look at where we have one qubit, so n is equal to 2, and then when we have two qubits, n is equal to 4. And then we can just use those equations I wrote down. So if you have, we have four probabilities for a standard quantum theory. We have a complex, so k is equal to 4. If we have two qubits, we have 16. And that's equal to 4 squared. So we're OK. In the case of real quantum theory, we have three probabilities required for a single qubit, or single real bit, they're sometimes called. But we need 10. We need 10 probabilities to characterize two real bits. And that's greater than 3 squared, last time I checked. And then in the Cartesianic case, we need 6. Just put in n equals 2 into this equation, you get 6. And if we have n equal to 4, so we have 2 Cartesianic bits, then we get 28, which is less than 6 squared. The 3 comes from putting 2 into that equation there.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, yeah. You see, 2 plus 1 times 2 okay. divided by 2 is 3. Yeah. Okay. So you can see, in some ways, I think the real case is more interesting. You can see that. When you have two real bits, if you have two, even within quantum theory, you can just constrain your systems to be real. So you might constrain your spin a half particle to lie in the zx plane for the bit. Then you only have three parameters characterizing your state. One of these is overall normalization. But then for two real bits, you have an extra parameter comes in. And if you want to do tomography on a pair of real bits where you have this constraint, then you can't do it locally. You can find 9 local measurements because you have 3 times 3. But then you need an extra measurement on your pair of real bits, which is corresponds to an entangled projector. So it's kind of strange. So one of the reasons for considering these frameworks of generalized probabilities is the following reason, is to try and come up with some reasonable postulates for quantum theory. So one way to motivate that is like this. We have ad hoc sort of so if you look at here's some examples. If you look at previous physics, you have Kepler's laws. For planetary motion. And they were quite nice mathematical laws, but they didn't seem very explanatory. They were just ad hoc postulated laws. And they were later explained by Newton's laws. Now, and one could claim that you need an explanation for Newton's laws as well. But I think certainly these laws are a lot more explanatory than these laws. Another example. You look at the Lorentz transformations. The Lorentz transformations were known before Einstein's theory of special relativity. They're the transformations under which Maxwell's equations are invariant. But they look very ad hoc. They're quite mathematical. You know, they involve this funny square root term. They're not the sort of thing that you would postulate by themselves. But then Einstein's special relativity postulates seem a lot more explanatory. Okay, so so quantum theory in its usual axiomatic form. With Hilbert space and so on. Complex Hilbert space even. Seems rather ad hoc. It's an odd mathematical structure to posit to describe nature. So it perhaps it belongs in this column. So then can we find something over here? So I'm going to give you some potential candidates for what happens over here. I don't think anything that myself or others have come up with has the quite the explanatory or sort of, you know, there's quite the sort of compelling nature of these examples. And so I think this problem is still really open, looking for something in this box that really is compelling. But you can see that already we introduced these axioms, these tomographic locality and information locality. And they told us, they constrained us to complex Hilbert space, or at least they accounted, they gave us the correct counting. So they gave us one feature of quantum theory. So we've sort of made some progress in this direction.
Say that again,
sorry.
So quantum theory was not the unique articles to generalized probability theory. Like, yeah, you mentioned there are other theories.
That's
so
right, yeah.
Do you have any idea for like, as to what conditions might distinguish quantum theory from the other articles to theories?
Yes. So I'll give you some, yeah. That's sort of been a subject of a lot of work in recent times. So I'll give you some conditions, and there's lots of, what you need to do is come up with a set of postulates just like here, or laws, anyway, a set of things you take to be true that constrain you to quantum theory. And I'll give you a few. I'll give you one example of such a set. There are a few more things out there in the literature, and they're interesting. I feel like that we still need better ideas here. But I can give you some set of things like that. So I'm going to go on a bit longer than I did yesterday. Dennis said I should make up for the time I lost yesterday. So the ones I'll give you are from a paper I wrote in 2002. And this is the one 0101012.
And there in the table on the left, what can you say about motivation for each of those laws? In the first.
Oh, the first one here?
Yeah.
On the left. I mean, I think they're not motivated. I think they're just ad hoc. They were found because they fit the data in each case. You know, I mean, these ones were the correct ones for you know the Maxwell's equations. The Maxwell's equations were used to fit the data of Faraday primarily.
So the motivation comes from the data.
Yeah. So they're sort of data. And even I think in quantum theory, one can argue the case, but certainly the origins of quantum theory sort of come from a special data. One can certainly argue about whether these things are really explanatory, and we know already that Newton's laws have been surpassed by general relativity. But I think one would rather have physics of this nature than this nature, if possible. And one of the great things about this kind of physics is that it makes progress easier. If you've got a better conceptual grip on the nature of your physical theory, then it's easier to go to the next physical theory. So from Einstein's special relativity, the step to general relativity wasn't so difficult. And the conceptual ideas that were necessary for general relativity, some of them have their origin in special. It's difficult to imagine going from this to general relativity. So I'll write down the five postulates I had in this paper. I'll give them in a different form. The form I wrote them on in this paper, it's a 9. So first postulate is I call it information. Could we use longer chalk? I found some pieces there. So if you have a system and it has a certain n, then if you have another system having the same n, then it should have the same properties. So for example, we already used the idea that k is a function of n. So the property as to how many probabilities you need to characterize a certain type of system depends only on n. And we're assuming that that's true. For other properties as well, such as the nature of the state space and so on, the shape of the state space and so on. I would give, if I had more time, I'd give more precise definitions of what I mean by these words. That's right. Yeah. So you can say, so for example, a spin a half particle has the same properties as the polarization degree of freedom of a photon, has the same properties as a two path Mach Zender interferometer, you keep seeing the same structure over and over again, and you can encode all of that as a qubit. So that's why the concept of a qubit is so useful, because you have this property. And that's the sort of justification for calling it information. It's kind of, in some ways, this is the central insight, or the beginning insight, let's say, of quantum information. Information is fungible. Sometimes how people say you can convert it from one form to another. Information locality. We discussed that already. Tomographic locality. We discussed that already. And then two more. Continuity. Continuity. This is the assumption that there exists a continuous reversible transformation between any pair of pure states. If you think about quantum theory, if you have two pure states for example, a spin half system, maybe you have spin up along the z direction and spin up along the x direction, then there exists a unitary transformation that will reversibly take the state from one to the other. And you can do it in a continuous way, so you can sort of build that transformation up slowly over time. So, maybe you apply a magnetic field and it transforms the state continuously from being up along the z direction to being up along the x direction. Postulate. This postulate rules out the classical case, because if you have a classical system, so for example, like this, then the pure states are these extremal points, and it's impossible to go reversibly from, for example, here to here in a continuous fashion, because you'd have to be here at some point, but here you're in a mixture. And if you go from here to here, if you want to go from a pure state to a mixed state, that's an irreversible transformation. So this rules out classical probability theory. And then the last postulate is the sort of cop-out postulate. So this says that systems are described by the smallest number of probabilities consistent with the other postulates. What this ends up meaning is that we should take the smallest value of R. I call that a cop-out axiom because I think this kind of simplicity axiom, especially one that refers, or postulate, especially a postulate that refers to the other postulates, especially seems not to be the right kind of thing you'd want here. But in any case, once you do this, then if you have, you can consider the k equals n case, but that's ruled out by this postulate. So you have to have k equals n squared. That's the next smallest case. And then the other postulates, well, then all these other postulates force you to quantum theory. So in particular, the kind of quantum theory that that Joe would have taught in his course, where you have density matrices, you have CP maps, and so on, all that stuff. You have positive operators for measurements, all that stuff. Here. There's a few assumptions in the background. So for example, assumption one, this idea that you can have a probability associated with a circuit is an assumption there in the background. What can we do? So it's worth saying before I finish, there's been a lot of work recently and getting rid of this simplicity axiom, different other axioms. They have the nice feature that they don't have a postulate or an axiom like this. So a few of the names involved in that work are Dakic and Bruckner, Marsanes and Muller, Ribella, Dariano, and Perinotti. And I also have a more recent paper, which you can read if you want. It's about 180 pages long, which gives you a different set of assumptions. These reconstructions tend to be quite, the mathematics is usually fairly simple, but they tend to be quite lengthy because you have to, you know, reconstruct all of this structure from a set of postulates that look very different. So it tends to be quite a lengthy kind of task. So I think all this recent work is really nice. This paper gets rid of, you know, these papers have some great ideas for getting rid of the simplicity assumption. But I still don't think we've found the right thing to fill in that question mark.
Yep. So which of these five assumptions rules out the toy model theory?
The continuity axiom, because that has a finite number of pure states. For example, it's also inconsistent with the subspace axiom when you apply it to composite systems. If you take two toy bits and then restrict yourself to some two-dimensional part of that, then you don't have another toy bit if you do it in the right way. So it's inconsistent in a different respect as well. Yeah. But it obviously violates the continuity assumption.
So why aren't you happy with your axioms?
Yeah, they don't strike me as having the same compelling nature as these other examples. I feel like there's something deeper. And the more I think about this, the more I sense that there's a much deeper set of ideas that can do this. I just haven't quite articulated it yet.